Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, the holidays are just around the corner, and you can never go wrong with the gift of a good book. And to help us with some great ideas is our book reviewer, Nancy Pearl, who joins us with some recommended reading for books from both this year and a few books from the past. Nancy is the author of the Book Lust series of books of recommended reading, and also the author of George and Lizzie, a novel, her first novel, which was published back in September. She joins us today with some titles for recommended reading and possible gifts for that book lover in your family today on Studio Tulsa. Nancy Pearl, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rich. It's nice to be with you again, even though it's by telephone wire.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year. Has it been a good year for books?
Well, for me, I have just been having a lot of trouble being captivated by a book, you know, starting it, reading the first paragraph and just knowing, oh my gosh, this is going to be a great experience. And by great, I mean a really enjoyable experience. And there were some books that did that for me, but not a lot. And this was, from my perspective, again, not a good year for thrillers.
Now, well, let's start on your list. One book that did make your list was a book that we featured on Studio Tulsa late in the summer.
Right.
And it was, I considered, a really good summer read. It's by Lady Hubbard, The Talented Ripkins. And I guess I would describe it as Marvel superheroes coming to fiction, but the superpowers are not all that.
Right. They're not for the benefit of mankind. So you're not going to turn to the Ripkins to save humanity necessarily. But I did enjoy this book. I read it early in the year. And it's the story of the Ripkins family of African Americans. And the main character is a 72-year-old man, Johnny Ripkins. And first of all, I was taken with that because he's 72. And, you know, I've come later in life to appreciating books that have heroes and main characters who are not in their 20s and 30s. I mean, you know, it seems more realistic to me somehow. But Johnny has gotten in trouble with his mob boss, and he needs to repay some money that he's taken from him. And so he sets out using his magic power, which is to be able to find places. He can make a map of places, any space that you can name, any place that you can name, even though he's never been there. So that's Johnny's kind of odd power. So one of his cousins, fire comes out of his mouth. His father could see colors that no one else could see. But he sets out on this quest to reclaim this money that has been buried around the Northeast, I think is where it's set. And he takes with him his late brother's daughter, who is one of those great kind of smarty pants kids that are fun to read about. I don't know how much fun they are in real life, but they're really fun to read about.
Now, what I loved about this book was that you only slowly begin to appreciate the talent of the Ripkins as the book goes on. We meet Johnny. We know Johnny's in some trouble. He's going to go to visit some relatives where he knows he has some money stashed. But only slowly but surely do we realize how talented the family is in having these odd superpowers. Now, his brother, I believe it was his brother, was somebody who could climb into anything and could get right. into anywhere. And so he made the maps. His brother would do the burglary.
Yes. And the other thing that I found interesting, and I wouldn't have recognized it if not for the blurb in the book description, that refers back to W.E.B. Du Bois's essay called The Talented Tenth.
Yes.
Which was written at the in the early part of the 20th century and said that 1 in 10 through education, and this was particularly a push for building institutions of higher colleges for African Americans and education, the importance of education, that 1 in 10 Black American men would become leaders, as Du Bois put it, leaders of their race in the world. I love Du Bois's emphasis on education, and certainly Booker T. Washington was influenced by him. So all of that together gave an added depth to the book.
And that was the direct emphasis for her writing the book in the first place. Yeah.
Right. And I love it, didn't you find it so interesting that this is the tack that she took?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's The Talented Ripkins by Lady Hubbard. Up next is 10 Restaurants That Changed America by Paul Friedman. And this is not the greatest restaurants in the world, but the
right.
ones that most changed America, the
yes.
most influential, if you would say.
Yes, and I think this is a perfect holiday gift for anyone who's interested in the culture of food and the culture of eating in America. It's just a history of these 10 different restaurants, ranging from Chez Panisse to Howard Johnson's, including Schraff's, which is a restaurant that used to have sundaes, I remember, with vanilla ice cream with chocolate sauce. I think they were one of the early places that did that. Delmonico's, the Four Seasons, Sylvia's, the famous soul food restaurant in Harlem. But I especially loved the Howard Johnson's essay and history, because I have a very distinct memory that when I was growing up in Detroit, there were no Howard Johnson's in Detroit itself. And someone told me that it was because Howard Johnson's ice cream didn't have a high enough butterfat content to meet the requirements for restaurants or something in Detroit. So you had to drive to Highland Park, which is a little city entirely surrounded by Detroit, to get ice cream and clams, fried clams, which was the big thing at Howard Johnson. So this was a book I thought, you know, I'm not a cook, but I'm interested in social histories, and I thought it was very interesting.
And I assume Delmonico's was the first instance of what we'd call American fine dining. Is that why that was included?
Yep.
Le Pavillon would be French haute cuisine in the 1940s.
Right. And Chez Panisse, of course, with the eat local and
organic food.
Organic food. And then Antoine's in New Orleans,
yes.
which I've eaten at. And, it has such a romantic New Orleans vibe. Old New Orleans, I think. Yeah, it was just great fun to read and would be a great gift.
That's 10 Restaurants That Changed America by Paul Friedman. My guest today is our longtime book reviewer, Nancy Pearl, who joins us today with some of her best reads of 2017. Up next is a very ambitious novel, which I haven't read, but the description of which really makes me want to read this. And this is 4-3-2-1.
Right. So this is an amazing novel, and it's 859 pages or so. It's has gotten a lot of press. Paul Auster is a writer that I greatly admire. I'm very interested in the way he talks about writing. There's some terrific collection of essays that he did a few years ago. But this is his first novel in maybe 7 or 8 years, and I just really admired this novel. It's the story of four boys, all named Archie Ferguson, all born to the same set of parents in the same place on the same day at the same time. And they are, in fact, the same boy, but this is four different possible versions of his life. And what's so interesting to me is the role that chance plays in the lives of these boys, because we meet them right after, they're born, and we follow them until they're in their middle 20s. And it makes you think about all the what ifs. So very early in the book, the first Ferguson, number one, says, "Such an interesting thought," Ferguson said to himself, "to imagine how things could be different for him even though he was the same boy in a different house with a different tree, the same boy with different parents, the same boy with the same parents who didn't do the same things they did now. What if his father was still a big game hunter, for example, and they all lived in Africa? What if his mother was a famous movie actress and they all lived in Hollywood? What if he had a brother or a sister? What if his great uncle Archie hadn't died and his own name wasn't Archie? What if he had fallen out of the same tree and had broken two legs instead of one? What if he had broken both arms and both legs? What if he had been killed? Yes, anything was possible, and just because things happened in one way didn't mean they couldn't happen in another.
It's all about alternate reality, and it's really a writing exercise in nature versus nurture.
It is. I think that one of the things I found fascinating is the way you know it's the same boy because similar events are echoed in each of these four lives. So even if they're different, and we don't, the other interesting thing about the book is that we don't follow Archie 1 from birth to age 27 or so. We read about Archie 1, Archie 2, Archie 3, Archie 4, say from birth to age 6, and then we start all over again with Archie 1, 6 to 12, and then 12 to, you know, whatever. I started out thinking that I didn't need to keep notes, you know, on this. But I have to say, and I marked, I mean, if you could see my copy of it, there's all these, sticky notes sticking out because there were just so many things that I loved about it that I wanted to remember. But then I started keeping notes, keeping just, you know, really brief things about the salient points of Archie One's life so I would remember and be able to keep it straight.
I think the one criticism I read about this was it was difficult to keep 4, 3, 2, and 1 all straight.
Right. But I think that's part of the fascination of it, too. I mean, you know, with a book this long, there's always, I believe, going to be quibbles about did it have to be this long? Did there have to be so much detail? But Archie Ferguson and indeed the author himself, Paul Auster, were both born in 1947. And so what this book is, in addition to this interesting study, the interesting thinking about nature versus nurture and the vicissitudes of life, is what you get is really a history of late 20th century, second half of the 20th century, what events were occurring. And boy, you know, that was a really, those last 50 years were pretty eventful. And I enjoyed that part. You know, people I've talked to who have read it really didn't, you know, they sort of felt they were being lectured to about those, about the rise of SDS and the sit-in at Columbia University. It's a very New York-centric book, but gosh, I just thought it was great.
And he uses a lot of his own life details telling the story about these four characters.
He does. Yeah. He does. And I mean, wouldn't that be interesting to sit down and, especially if you have as good a mind as Paul Auster does, to sit down and sort of think, well, what if this had been different? What if this one time that I went to this particular camp in the summer, I went to a different camp and met these people? I mean, I think that kind of what-ifing, which I'm kind of addicted to, is which is why I wrote George and Lizzie, which doesn't right. really deal with that. That's my own what-ifs. But, you know, I think this is an interesting way of incorporating your life in fiction.
Now, your next two books are not new books. They're
no.
really old books, in at least the first case. But these are books for young readers.
They are.
Coming of age, maybe 10 to 12 or even a little earlier for Edward Eger. And you've talked about Edward Eger's 7-Day Magic before. But you put this on the list again, and A Long Way from Verona by Jane Gardam.
Right.
What is special about these two books?
Well, I love Edward Eger's books. He wrote, I think, just 7 books and died much, much too young. And he was one of the few authors that I got to hear speak when I was a child and was reading these books. When we think about children's fantasy now, the person that we think about and the person that we tend to judge books by is, of course, J.K. Rowling, who, you know, we all owe, I believe, a huge debt to because she really the Harry Potter books are fantastic. But there's a different way of approaching magic and approaching fantasy. And what Edward Eger did was build on the not the theories, because that sounds too highfalutin, but built on the way that another British writer, E. Nesbitt, thought and wrote about fantasy for children. And what E. Nesbitt, the books that E. Nesbitt wrote, and probably the most famous is Five Children and It and The Enchanted Castle. And those were written, I think, early in the 50s or the 40s. So what E. Nesbitt did was sort of posit this way of thinking about magic and of kids encountering magic, which is that they find something that's magic, they have to learn to tame it, to figure out how to use it, and then they have to use it. And Edward Eger's first book was called Half Magic, which is when a family, a group of brothers and sisters, find what looks like a nickel, but turns out to be, if you make a wish on it, you get exactly half your wish. So, which was wonderful. And this kind of magic was the kind of magic that I dreamed about when I was a child, not fantasy, like the Harry Potter books or the other books that have come out that are so popular, which, you know, come up with a fantastical universe. Instead, what I loved was the possibility of and I think other kids love, was the possibility of magic in your everyday life. I mean, finding this little coin in Half Magic and saying, you know, just you're holding it and you just sort of are thinking about your friends who are all away for the summer and saying, oh, I wish my friends would be here now. And then finding out the next day that they've all somehow appeared halfway between wherever they were and home, and then learning how to deal with that and how to do all that. So, and use magic. And so in 7 Day Magic, which is one of my favorites, it's about reading, and it's about the kids in two different families who every week go to the library and check out whatever magic books they can find. And of course, they're big fans of E. Nesbitt's books. And they check out a book that doesn't have a title, just an old book. Susan, one of the characters, checks it out and notices when the librarian checks it out for her, that the librarian is looking at her in a very, you know, quizzical way. And then they discovered that this book has one particular magic quality, which is that it becomes a different book for every person who reads it. And it becomes a book that's written exactly for them and what they need at that time. So here's a quote from that. If you have understood about the book so far, you will know that for each person, its power was different, because to each person, it was the particular book that person had always longed to find. Isn't that wonderful?
That is great. That's 7 Day Magic by Edward Eger from 1958. And the other book for, I guess, young girls in 1971?
Now, yeah, you know, it's you frequently find it in the teen section.
This is a long way from
Verona.
They
have it at all, but it's really for adults. It's just a fabulous book. Jane Garda, many people know her because she really gained a lot of popularity with her series, four-book series, beginning with Old Filth. But that was late in her career, and her earlier books, particularly Bilgewater and A Long Way from Verona, I think are just must reads. A Long Way from Verona is about a young woman, and she's writing this book. Her name is Jessica Vai, and she's writing this book kind of contemporaneously, so you're looking at the world through her eyes. Back in the 1940s, it's wartime. And she starts by saying, I ought to tell you at the beginning that I am not quite normal, having had a violent experience at the age of 9. I will make this clear at once, because I have noticed that if things seep out slowly through a book, the reader is apt to feel let down or tricked in some way when he eventually gets the point. So what is the violent event in Jessica Vai's life? The violent experience is basically that she meets this author, and he's speaking at her school, and she sends all of her writing to him. She just runs home, gathers it all together, and thrusts it at him as he's getting on a train. And months later, he writes to her and says, Jessica Vi, something like, Jessica Vi, you are a writer beyond all possible doubt. And that changes her life. It's so wonderful. It's readers who love character-driven fiction, who love coming-of-age stories, and who just, you know, who are interested in meeting just a lovely, lovely heroine who looks at the world in her own particular way, should not miss A Long Way from Verona.
All right. My guest today is Nancy Pearl, our longtime book reviewer, as we look at some books from the past as well as books from this year that have piqued her interest and she's been reading this year. Now, you said it was a bad year for mysteries and thrillers, so you went back to a 1980s book, Uncivil Seasons by Michael Malone, who we probably best know as the soap opera writer and showrunner for right. One Life to Live.
For years and years and years. So Michael Malone, his early books are among my favorite books, and I go back to them frequently. And I have to say, all these books, even though they're old, are still in print, so you can get them. And I hope the library has them, that beautiful new library that you all have in Tulsa. So Uncivil Seasons is just a wonderful mystery set in a small town outside Chapel Hill, actually, in North Carolina. And this has a great first paragraph. I'll just read you a few sentences in it. Two things don't happen very often in Hillston, North Carolina. We don't get much snow, and we hardly ever murder one another. Suicide is more our style. We're a polite college town, and our lives are sheltered by old trees. Isn't that wonderful?
That is a great first line, but you now know that there's going to be a murder.
Yes, you do. You do. And the two main characters are policemen. So in some ways, it's a police procedural. But what I loved again about this book, and I love it each time I read it, is just the friendship between the two detectives, these two guys, and how you get to know both of them and how they come from very different backgrounds in Hillston but have come together on the police force and are investigating a murder that involves some of the town's best known and wealthiest inhabitants.
Mm. A good read, huh? That you don't mind going back to over and over again.
A fabulous read.
Uncivil Seasons by Michael Malone. Now, up next, you have two new books from this year, Crooked Letter by Tom Franklin.
So, actually, this came out a few years ago, but it's in, I think, a new, a lovely trade paperback edition from Morrow. This is, again, one of my favorite books. See, this is a year I went back and did so much rereading. I did not own, I own all the three previous books that we talked about, and, you know, they have pride of place in my house. I did not own Crooked Letter, which I had greatly enjoyed when I originally read it, but for some reason didn't have a copy of it. So I went out and bought a brand new copy of Crooked Letter, because I found that I couldn't forget it, that it was such a powerful book. It's set in the 1970s. Or begins in the 1970s, when these two boys, Larry Ott and Silas Jones, are friends in a small town in rural Mississippi, but they're very, very different. Larry is the son of lower middle class work parents, and Silas is African American. He raised by a single mother. Father is gone. But then one day, what happened when they were in high school is that Larry took a girl to the dance, to the senior prom, and the girl disappeared. And even though nothing has ever been proven about Larry's involvement in the disappearance and likely death of this girl, because she's never been found, her body was never found, the town has blamed him. And he's really, as the years went on, progressively retreated into himself, having very little to do with anyone else. And then Silas has become a policeman and takes a job on the police force in this small Mississippi town where he grew up, and another girl disappears.
Hmm.
Oh, it is so good, Rich. It is so, so, so good. I don't recommend a lot of books for book discussions because often there's not enough there. That they're just, you know, fun reads, but there's not enough there to really talk about. But, oh, Crooked Letter is just so good. And there's so much to talk about, issues of race, issues of the kind of blame that certain people get because they're different from everyone else for in whatever way. This is a fabulous book.
That's Crooked Letter by Tom Franklin. We have time for one more.
Let's do Lucky Ones.
Okay.
By Julianne Pacheco.
Tell us about it.
Okay, so this is, it's being marketed as a novel, but I have to say it's really a collection of short stories, interlinked short stories. But it's all set, primarily set, the stories are mostly set in Colombia during the drug wars. And what I loved about this book, I mean, fabulous writing, just such evocative writing. But I also admired the way Julianne Pacheco, the stories are told from various points of view, so that each story, there's stories that are set in a girls' school, a very expensive girls' school in Colombia. And kids who are unaware of girls who are unaware of their fathers, what their fathers do for a living. There's one story set in New York in the 80s, the drug scene in New York. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to see what she does next. These are just, these are strong, powerful, sometimes violent stories, and she's a wonderful, wonderful writer.
All right, Lucky Ones by Julianne Pacheco. Nancy, we look forward to lots of good reading in 2018.
And yes, thank that you. Should be our wish. That's my wish for this coming year for us all.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Rich.
Nancy Pearl is our book reviewer here on Studio Tulsa. She's the author of the Book Lust series of books of recommended reading and the author of the novel George and Lizzie, a novel which came out back in September. You can see her titles for recommended reading on our website, publicradiotulsa.org. And while you're there, you can get a few more ideas at the NPR Book Concierge, a guide to great 2017 reads, which is also available at publicradiotulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.